Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. With one big event in the film calendar just wrapped up and another one about to happen, we couldn't really do today's show without inviting in a couple of film critics to discuss the things they saw at the Berlin Film Festival and what they hope will happen during Sunday's Oscars ceremony. Joining me on the programme today will be the film critics Jason Solomons and Tim Robey, who will also be reviewing a couple of this week's new releases. Elsewhere on the programme, we'll head to a gallery in central London to discover the history of cross-dressing through a photography exhibition. That's all ahead on the show, so do stay tuned. Tim and Jason, welcome to the programme. Now, last Sunday, the Berlin Film Festival drew to a close with Adina Pintilli's Touch Me Not taking the coveted Golden Bear Award and Wes Anderson collecting Best Director for his upcoming film Isle of Dogs. Tim, let's start with you. You were there for much of the festival. What caught your eye? Was it the two aforementioned movies?
I certainly enjoyed Isle of Dogs a lot. Great choice for an opening film. They had Grand Budapest Hotel as their opening film a few years ago, which is the perfect choice for an opening film. Just think of all the star power and the red carpets and the general fun value. And with Isle of Dogs, even though this is an animation, again, it's him returning to Fantastic Mr. Fox style animation, he's still got all those names attached. You know, you've still got, you know, Bill Murray, Ed Norton, Bryan Cranston, Tilda Swinton. So a lot of them turned up. But the film, I found it surprisingly bleak, which I enjoyed. I thought it was a slight sort of departure for him in terms of tone. Because the problem with Wes Anderson sometimes is you feel just locked into the same sensibility over and over again. But with this, it's about a bunch of starving dogs scavenging on top of a landfill. And it's openly indebted to Akira Kurosawa. And it's quite sort of stern and bleak, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, there's certainly some funny bits too, but I thought the design was brilliant, and I'm glad he won something for it. I think I would have preferred him to win the bear, probably.
Just what about your reading of things? A vintage year? I mean, what was your sort of...
I was only in Berlin very briefly, kind of in and out. I always find Berlin a bit depressing. They always give a prize to things about Romanian prostitutes or something by Romanians. It is very, very bleak under Dieter Kostik. I sort of can't wait for it to change and get a bit more fun back into it, because the films struggle. You know, the big auteurs hold back for Cannes, and then none of them are in kind of the awards conversation movies that you get in Venice and Toronto or Telluride. So I find it occupies a strange kind of checkpoint in the midst of the festival season, and hasn't managed to carve out a niche for anything else more experimental or more kind of sterner European art house that with a kind of bit of success. So you know, it's kind of cool. What I do like about it is I was involved with the European Shooting Stars this year, and it kind of picks these kind of 10 kind of people to watch throughout the years, you know, who are going to go on to become famous. And they've had people like Daniel Craig, Alicia Vikander, Matthias Schoenaerts, all of those who we'll talk of a bit later. All of those have been through that system, and I was there kind of looking at them this year. So I did see a couple of films for the representation of that, including a film called Becoming Astrid, which is about Astrid Lindgren, who's very, very famous in Sweden for making the Pippi Longstocking stories. So she's kind of like the Enid Blyton of Sweden. She's kind of massive. Everyone knows her. Or do they? So Alba August was playing young Astrid as she was when she was a child, and then becoming an adult and learning how to write and clunk away on a typewriter in 30s Sweden. So it was about girl finding place in very stern society. I thought it was very good, a brilliant performance in a very kind of heritage sort of art housey movie, the sort of thing that could actually travel quite well because it's got that kind of prettiness of the Swedish countryside. And if people know Pippi Longstocking, I don't think they know who Astrid Lindgren is quite, but they will soon. And Alba August is the daughter of Billy and Pernilla. You know Billy and Pernilla, don't you? Billy August and Pernilla August. She's their daughter, and I think she's terrific. I think she's going to be a real star, like a kind of proper actressy star when she grows up. She's very good.
And it's interesting, and it's called the Young European Shooting Stars, and young they are. We had 18-year-olds. Very precocious. I mean,
it's horrible.
Must be refreshing to see these real youngsters.
No, it's not. It's awful.
Shout out for a really good German actor in the mix called Franz Rogowski, who I think is basically like the German Joaquin Phoenix.
He's better
than
Joaquin, yeah.
But he's really great. And he was in two films in competition. He was in a film called Transit, which Christian Petzold made. And then rather a good, and again quite melancholy, comedy called In the Isles, co-starring Sandra Hüller from Tony Erdmann. And I thought he was excellent in both those films.
Yeah, that's the other one I saw.
He's a really big star.
Yeah. He's a really big star already. There's also, you know, they are very young as well. In fact, I was talking to Alba August and I sort of said, oh, do you remember growing up on any of your dad's films? You know, she goes, oh, yes, it was the lovely summer we had when he was shooting Goodbye Bafana in South Africa. And I thought, God, blimey, I think I reviewed that when it was in Berlin. Making me feel terribly old.
What about this idea of the role of these festivals? We're going to obviously talk about some of the Oscars in a moment, but is this fit for purpose? I mean, Jason was saying, playfully, I think, about some of the problems with Berlin. Did it sort of deliver for you in terms of its brief?
Well, I didn't think this was a vintage Berlin, but I think even a vintage Berlin doesn't necessarily give you those kind of films. It doesn't necessarily do the Oscar films. Funnily enough, Call Me By Your Name was actually there last year. And so it was A Fantastic Woman, which I'm going to talk about later. But I think Berlin is at its best when it's finding more niche and esoteric and obscure things. And there was one that I really did love. Guy Maddin came with his new pair of films, actually, to Berlin. One of them's a short, 10-minute short, called Accidents. But the main one, the feature, is called The Green Fog. And it is his most enjoyable film ever.
Really?
It's
oh, I love
absolutely
his stuff.
Wonderful. So Guy Maddin mainly specialises in doing kind of silent movie pastiche, where he goes out there and he uses his mates and gets them to look like they're in a silent film, and it's all quite kind of arch and funny and black and white usually. But this is very different because this is a film entirely composed of clips from other movies, all of which are set in San Francisco. So it's like San Francisco in film, and it's plucked from every possible source except one, and that is Vertigo, because the film tells the story of Vertigo using clips from other films about San Francisco. So when you've got the rooftop chase in Vertigo in your head, you're looking at every rooftop chase you can possibly imagine from every San Francisco film. Exactly. So you've got like Bullet, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But the thing is that he really cleverly takes you through the narrative of Vertigo, and then he goes, right, well, now we've got to do the falling into the bay near the Golden Gate. So here are some clips from films doing that as well. And they speak to each other, and they're very funny in the way they speak to each other. There's one bit where Rock Hudson in a bad kind of 70s suit is sitting staring at a TV screen, and what we see on it is an NSYNC video. And he nods approvingly, and it's just really funny.
I do love Guy Maddin. I loved my Winnipeg. I think he's terrific.
He's
and I
great.
Did see. I just saw one still from. I missed the Guy Maddin. I saw one still in the brochure. And I was like, that's the film
it's
I want to see.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It will come to the London Film Festival, etc.
Because you imagine also that sounds like it could be almost too clever for its own good. So pretty good achievement to steer that on the right
it's
side.
Really
of that.
Funny. That's the thing. And I think it will be a special treat for cinephiles to kind of spot all the films. But at the end credits, he plays the kind of title cards from every single film that he's used. And you see them all, and that's a great sequence.
Is this
as well.
One of those films that I doubt he's probably got clearance for all of them? Can it only play at festivals and kind of in academia?
That's
and
possibly
that sort of thing?
True. It would be very much like a festival hit. But last year, or was it 2 years ago, the London Film Festival put his film, The Forbidden Room, up on the IMAX for one screen, which was brilliant. And I reckon they might do the same. I'll try and get them to do the same this year. I'll force them.
Let's start a campaign.
Yeah, exactly.
Hashtag
yeah.
IMAX
on,
for Maddin.
Exactly.
Watch this space. The Berlin Film Festival is over. The film event everyone is looking forward to, probably. This weekend is the Oscars. Jason, what about the Oscars?
I'm not going to win this year.
But are you excited by this year's nominees? Berlin maybe didn't get the juices flowing, but plenty to enjoy from the Academy, do you think?
Yeah, I do. I mean, they come off the back of the BAFTAs, which were actually, you know, the red carpet was very interesting at the BAFTAs. I thought the ceremony was terribly dull, but the awards were also quite dull until Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri managed to win both British film and best film. So it kind of bookended the ceremony, suggesting that it has the momentum going into the Oscars. And now I wasn't quite sure. I thought it was a film that has enjoyed its bit of controversy. It's been, you know, elitist, sexist, racist, dwarfist, everything. And it's managed to kind of fend them off, rather like its central character, Mildred Hayes, who's kind of, you know, puts on the boiler short suit, does up the bandana and goes into battle and kind of kicks everything in a way. So I think she's a great emblem for our times. So I do think that's my favourite to win Best Picture. Whether it is a classic Oscar Best Picture, I don't know, because I think that has changed in the last 3 or 4 years. Mm. That all bets are off as to what that is anymore. Moonlight wasn't one of those, and now it is. So, you know, maybe Three Billboards is. It's certainly one of the kind of indiest Best Picture winners we've ever had, I think. So the only thing I think is that Lady Bird could still do it. By its kind of simple charms and the nature of it being the film directed by a woman and for women and starring women and about women and with women in it. So I think that has a kind of simple, kind of uncontroversial charm to it that might just see it do this kind of quick reverse right at the end. I mean, we're expecting now kind of surprises at the Oscars. You know, it's almost not a surprise if the favourite wins. So I'm expecting a kind of, you know, if there's not a massive mix-up right at the end and someone reading out the wrong winner and then going, nah, I will be surprised.
Tim, what about that point? It's an interesting, I mean, actually, the ceremony is going to be interesting because we've got all these big issues. You've got, obviously, sexual harassment, sort of ongoing rumblings of that. gun control recently. There's still questions about race. How will people be attired? What are they going to say? How political will the speeches be? Is that going to be as compelling a narrative almost as the film narratives that Jason's talking about?
Maybe more so. I mean, yeah, I think it's going to be a very nervous Oscars, actually, because everyone's going to feel like they have to be on their best behaviour and saying the right thing and not being put in the wrong box or tarred with that
brush.
Will
they be, though?
You know? Well, I just hope that some people just relax and just don't take it quite so seriously as that, because, come on, it's just an awards ceremony. This is not a United Nations summit. But also, I'm getting a bit fed up of the Oscars this year, and it's partly because the same four people keep winning all the acting awards, which I just find profoundly boring whenever it happens. It's like, what's the point of film awards if we're just going to give every single Best Actress award to Frances McDormand for Three Billboards? Gary Oldman gets everything for Darkest Hour. Alison Janney gets Supporting Actress for I, Tonya every single time. And now Sam Rockwell is the runaway favourite for Best Supporting Actor. And I'm just like, why? Why can't we kind of recognise some other really good acting from other films? Mm. Someone like Leslie Manville in Phantom Thread, for instance, or indeed Laurie Metcalf.
Well, they are nominated.
They're just nominated, they win. But I just don't want everyone to always win everything.
I know, but
you know,
how,
it's
how
just
do
really
we do
boring.
That? Do we just change the voting system? Do we sort of say that if you voted at the BAFTAs, you can't vote at the Oscars?
I mean,
the point is that everyone is a member of the guild and then...
Yeah, there's nothing we can do about it, but I just wish that, you know, that all awards bodies didn't just line up behind each other to say, well, of course, everyone's going to give it to Sam Rockwell, so let's do that.
Yeah,
you know, it's
it would be nice
boring.
If Laurie Metcalf could come along and kind of best Alison Janney.
I want one surprise out of those four, and that will make the night much more lively. I think it will be pretty lockstep and deadening if all four of them win again.
Why does that happen? Because it does appear that every now and again you get a year where there is that momentum, Jason, between particular performances, and as Tim says, they're sort of telegraphed, often months out. Can it be that these are simply four performances so compelling they're irresistible? Or is there a weird bit of background sort of politicking that goes on?
I think there's a sort of consensus that forms. I mean, people say, oh, it's a very open season in about November. And then the first award happens, the Golden Globes. Like, oh, right, well, Gary Oldman's got it on lock then. And it sort of just all follows. It's not. Listen, I think that with someone like Frances McDormand, it's a kind of, you know, for the ages performance of a for the ages character, and you're a bit unlucky to come up against her this year, even if you're good. Like Sally Hawkins is very good in The Shape of Water, there's no doubt about it. Everyone else is pretty good as well. Saoirse Ronan's terrific, but they're not Frances McDormand, who's created, I think, a sort of iconic movie character. Mildred, I even know the name, Mildred Hayes. The last one that I remember the name of is Marge Gunderson, and that was 20 years ago. So, you know, she's one of those. She does it occasionally. So I think that one I give. For Gary Oldman, yeah, it would be nice if some guild went and sort of said, you know what, it's just an impression with makeup on, let's give it to someone else, you know, because Daniel Day-Lewis is, I think, terrific as Reynolds Woodcock, and yet it's Daniel
but
Day-Lewis,
he can't win
so
again,
that would bore you as well.
Daniel Day-Lewis is not going to win again. I think I'd love it if Timothée Chalamet won, but he won't.
He's brilliant.
He's absolutely brilliant. But the film that I definitely really want to see win at least one Oscar is Get Out. And I really want it to win original screenplay. I want it to beat Three Billboards in original screenplay so that Jordan Peele gets an Oscar and everyone recognises Get Out was a massive, great entertainment and a really big deal and had things to say. I think it even has a sneaking chance in Best Picture as well. There's been a lot of talk about this.
They're very late kind of money we're going on to Get Out.
And I'm thrilled that Daniel Kaluuya was nominated because that could have not happened, but that's great. But yeah, I don't know. It's I'm going to be a bit miserable if Shape of Water and Three Billboards just clean up between them, because they're two of my least favourites.
I don't think Shape of Water's got it. I think it's kind of the drought.
Well, it's going to win Best Director, though, isn't it? It will win about five or six of the kind of design
and
categories, and it will win Best Director. So it will actually be the mathematically the big winner, but I think.
Yeah, it's not my favourite at all. It's done very well at the British box office, which I'm slightly surprised at. It's not my favourite film at all. I'm not against it as such. It's just not the thing that I like. I think the fish thing is kind of getting in its way. Everyone kind of is on US TV kind of going, oh, what, the fish movie? Oh, the one in which she sleeps with a fish. Oh, so I think if I was the PR behind that, I'd be like, how do we stop people thinking he's not even a fish? He's got legs. So, but it's too late.
Does he have gills, though?
I don't know what they are.
I think there are some sort of gills in there.
They look gillish as well. Yeah. I'll tell you what he has got, which fishes don't have.
Let's just leave that pregnant pause there for one second. Okay, in one word, what's the big surprise? Jason?
Lady Bird.
I'm going to call Willem Dafoe.
Oh, I like it. Well, the Oscars will take place this Sunday, 4th of March, and see how clever our panellists look, or not, by tuning in. It's broadcast on the ABC in the US and on Now TV here in the United Kingdom. Before we discuss some of this week's film releases, we're going to take a quick break from cinema to visit a new exhibition that's just opened here in London. Filmmaker and photography collector Sebastian Liefschitz has drawn some rare pictures on the practice of cross-dressing from his extensive archive. From 1880 onwards, the exhibition explores fascinating characters such as Bambi, a renowned Algerian-French transsexual woman. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Sebastian at the Photographer's Gallery about the exhibition titled Undercover, A Secret History of Crossdressers.
I'm interested in every aspect of the cross-dressing, or I would say the queer culture, because here we use the word cross-dressing, but it's not only about cross-dressing, it's more than that. The spectrum of, I would say, the situation behaviors of all these individuals, it's not only about cross-dressing. Sometimes it's about identity, about the transgender people, and sometimes it's about cross-dressing, sometimes it's about games, sometimes it's about cabaret, sometimes it's about prisoner of war. There is so different situations. It's about also the feminist movement, where the clothes of men were used in a political way. Sometimes it was also to provoke men and the establishment, you know, to just to realize what was the situation of women and this unfair situation.
And it's interesting that, you know, looking here at the exhibition, how some crossdressers, it was quite, not mainstream, but it was quite widespread, more than people would know. There's a few clubs, for example, there's one in Paris in front of us, Le Chat Noir, then there's some in Miami in the 30s. And they were incredibly successful. You know, people used to go there. So, of course, they had to hide, but it was also quite widespread.
The thing is, today, queer culture is very big in the media. Probably a lot of people think that it's something new, that it has no past, but it's not true. When you see all these pictures, then you realize that there is a kind of prehistory of queer culture. These people were invisibles probably in the society at that time, but they had existed. They have existed. They had a life, probably with a kind of rebellious spirit. They are the pre-punk of today, I would say, or of the 70s. This is what I love about all these pictures. They are very mysterious, but they give you an idea that the past is not exactly what we think. The past is not so conservative, so rigid as we can think today. It's more complex than this. It's a kind of mix of marginal people and conservative people and the ones in between, I would say. And this exhibition is really an homage, a kind of tribute to these rebels people.
And if we may talk about some parts of the exhibition, for example, I love the Washington community. I never heard it before. Would you mind telling us briefly about who are they?
Well, the Washington community is completely unknown, because sometimes you could find these cross-dressers in very different type of location. Of course, there is a cabaret, but there was also the private places, like home, apartment, where they used to do some party. And everything was very secret, very underground. And I found these pictures in America, and you could see that there is a kind of very intimate society, very private, where people could meet at home, and they could organize some party where they could cross-dress with a lot of freedom and fun. The thing is, what is very weird is that I could find the pictures, because, of course, these pictures were very dangerous. If someone could find them, then your life could be destroyed, because the law, the morality at that time, were very hostile to any marginal's behavior, I would say. And especially to cross-dressers, because they were very scandalous people. And the funny thing also about the Washington community is that you see that the model of reference that these men choose, the middle-class housewife, they are not the glamorous Hollywood actresses. It's more like the very bourgeois woman, which is weird. Most of them wanted to look like very distinguished women and not scandalous. This is that was for me a discover.
Another thing that we have to mention is Bambi as well. I know you made a documentary, yeah. And so we're here in front of some of Bambi pictures. And I have to say, Sebastian, fascinating. I mean, what a beautiful character. Tell us a bit more about her.
Well, Bambi was born in Algeria in 1935. And for until she was six, she was really convinced that she was a little girl. And she was authorized to dress her dress sisters. Then at the age of six, she had to go to school. And her mother asked her to cut her hair and to stop to wear like a little girl. And for her, it was really a kind of disaster, because then she realized that she was a little boy, but feeling deep in herself that she was a little girl. And for so many years, she had to live like that, you know, with on the outside, like a little boy, but feeling the opposite inside. But Bambi was lucky, because when she was 15, there was a group of cross-dressers from a Parisian cabaret that made a tour in Algeria. And of course, Bambi heard of it. So she went and see her show at the casino in Alger, and she was completely fascinated. For her, it was a kind of hope that it's going to be her life, and that she had to go to Paris to live with all these cross-dressers from the cabaret scene. And then, so she did it, actually. At the age of 18, she came to Paris. It was the early 50s. And she worked in the cabaret for like 20 years. And she had a crazy and very funny life. And then at the age of 30, she realized that she couldn't keep on like that. And so she decided to quit the cabaret scene and to go back to study, to get her diploma, and then to become a French teacher. And this is exactly what she did. And also to become a completely anonymous woman into the French society. And for 30 years, she was a French teacher in a very small school, first in the suburb of Cherbourg, and then in the suburb of Paris. And now she's a whole lady living in Paris, and she's retired, and she had really a very nice life, was full of friends. And what fascinates me in the life of Bambi, this is all this transformation. It's not only the cabaret period, it's the whole thing, you know, how she recreated her life many times, the courage that she had to assume who she was, even if the context, even if the society were against, and sometimes very, very hard. She didn't care. There was no negotiation. For her, she had to be who she was.
Undercover, A Secret History of Crossdressers is on at the Photographers Gallery until the 3rd of June. And I'm assured by none other than Jason Solomons that it's excellent. So two recommendations for the price of one. This is the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards, and Jason and Tim Roby. Now, gents, we've got a couple of today's new releases to discuss, including A Fantastic Woman. This Chilean drama took several awards at last year's Berlin Film Festival, including the Silver Bear, and has been nominated for nothing less than an Oscar this year in the Best Foreign Language Film category. Jason, perhaps you give us a bit of an overview of what this is about and the kind of mark that it makes.
Yeah, it goes very well with Fernando's little package there from Photographer's Gallery about cross-dressing. In fact, it takes it further, actually, because it's about transgender women. In fact, many people were thinking that the actress who plays the lead, a woman called Marina, played by an actress called Daniela Vega, was sort of in line for being the first transgender acting nominee. It's up for, as you say, Best Foreign Language Movie, and I think it stands a very good chance in that category. It's up against Loveless, which I love. It's up against The Square, which I think's quite good, but I think The Fantastic Woman is something else. Its director Sebastian Lelio describes it as a transgenre film about a transgender person, and it's very much like that. It's a musical fantasy, it's a comedy, it's a sort of Douglas Sirk melodrama about a woman whose boyfriend, elderly boyfriend, dies in her arms while they're sort of about to make love in their Santiago apartment. And she's a sort of nightclub singer and cabaret artist, and she takes him to hospital, and everyone keeps wanting to know, well, who are you? Are you the lover? Are you the mother? Are you relative? Then the family come and they want to know who this person is, and it's all about identity. Everyone wants to foist a reading onto Marina Vidal, played by Daniela Vega, and her travails through it, her sort of dignity through it, the way she navigates that in high heels is remarkable. It's a fantastic, fluid performance in a beautifully fluid film that had me kind of sort of wrong-footed at every turn. I thought it was excellent.
And it's interesting, of course, that Daniela Vega, as I understand it, was originally a sort of consultant and advisor on the piece, but then it sort of coalesced in the director's mind. She, he realised he wanted that
Sebastian
presence.
Was working with her to find out what it was like to be transgender in Santiago, what it felt like, and a lot of those feelings that he was talking to Daniela Vega about sort of ended up seeping into the character. And he woke up one morning and said, oh, she's got to play it. And so he sent her the first draft and said, please, would you play it? She went, what? I'm not even an actress. But she is. I tell you, she's more than an actress. She's an artist. She's fantastic in it.
She may not have been nominated for an Oscar, but will be the first transgender person to, I think, appear at the awards or to present an award, as I understand.
Yeah, she's
it,
one of the presenters that, which is for the ceremony. That's right.
A breakout as well. And again, it feels like a film, a performance, indeed a bit of a story in terms of the background to him that's kind of right for the moment in a lot of ways.
Very much so, yeah. And a really trailblazing impression she makes. I wish she'd actually picked up more awards herself, including at Berlin, for instance. She would have been the first transgender person to win an acting prize there. But the film has gone down very well too in general, and I like it very much. I see it as a follow-up to the director's previous film Gloria, in that it's another portrait of a woman alone. And Gloria was about a middle-aged woman on the sort of Santiago singles dating scene, basically, played by Paulina Garcia in another brilliant performance.
Who did win Best Actress at Berlin.
She did, yeah. I see them as companion pieces in a way. And I like that he's done that, because he's sort of... It means that the kind of trans issue is not the only issue. It's also about kind of solitude and...
Well, I was going to ask about this. I mean, and I guess the films that are most impactful emotionally are stories that speak to everybody. And of course, they can tell a particular powerful narrative. But I guess if you have great, thoughtful filmmaking, really powerful performances, they tell something about the human condition for everyone, and that's the measure of
their always
success.
Do, and that's why a film like Call Me By Your Name, for instance, has been extraordinary, and in fact God's Own Country, an English film about a gay romance, have both been phenomenally successful with women. Women have come back to those films time and time again, even though it's a male gay story in both cases. So I think, yeah, and Fantastic Woman is one of those films that kind of steps across that boundary and has a more universal resonance. I think it has a very strong chance of winning Best Foreign Film for all of these reasons, and it does feel like the most topical film of the year, really.
Well, more power to them. A Fantastic Woman is out today, as is our next film, which is Red Sparrow, this thriller based on the Sparrow School in Kazan in eastern Russia, where young women were trained in sexual entrapment during the Cold War. Tim, what about this? This is divided opinion, is it fair to say? What did you make of Red Sparrow?
I had some serious trouble with this film. it goes on a very long time, and it feels as though it's dug into this historical idea, but uses it mainly as an excuse for Jennifer Lawrence to take her clothes off as often as possible in as many slightly dubious rapey situations as the film can contrive, including in a sauna, in a bathroom, in a swimming pool, in various hotel rooms, in the training academy, and she gets very naked quite often. Obviously, there's been this big hoo-ha about her just sort of taking charge of that and wanting to do it and kind of take control of it. But I feel that the film personally is like a bad context to do it in. And I think the film is also contriving loads of kind of unnecessary torture as well. There's some really nasty stuff with like people's skin being scraped off and stuff. It's not a particularly pleasant experience, and I didn't think that it had the style to kind of pull it off satisfyingly in a way that I thought Atomic Blonde did better. Atomic Blonde didn't have a particularly great plot, actually, but it had serious style, and I think this film falls down there, which is a shame. It's not her fault. I just found the film pretty nasty.
Yeah. It's interesting what Tim was saying about male gaze films before, because I don't know who Red Sparrow's for. Obviously, it's got Jennifer Lawrence naked a lot of the time, doing some ballet and then becoming a sort of hit person. And then she's kind of pulled between the Russians and the Americans. And is she playing one against the other? And who's the baddie? Is it Jeremy Hines or Kieran Hines? Or there's just like every
so many
shot.
Characters.
So it's Charlotte Rampling, hello. It's, oh, Joel Edgerton, hello, how are you? Everyone else you sort of know, they all kind of come in. It's almost amusing to see them in their kind of doing their Russian accents or whatever. It's kind of nonsense film, directed by Francis Lawrence, who, of course, gained many plaudits for directing Jennifer originally in the first Hunger Games films. So that was
interesting. Does that sort of explain this? Has somebody said, well, hang on, that kind of worked, and could you guys sort of rustle up something a bit like that?
Is
that
what's happened here? Katniss Everdeen is supposed to be this feminist icon, but I don't see that Dominica or Katerina, whatever her name is, she keeps changing it, so I don't know, is supposed to be. I mean, yes, in the end, I suppose, no spoiler, she kind of comes out best, so is she a strong woman? I mean, she's a strong woman, but I mean, she goes through a lot of, you know, taking your knickers off.
She actually gets raped in the film.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not like jolly fun for the Hunger Games.
It's really grim and nasty piece of work, I thought. And a lot nasty, grim, nasty and long. At least life is nasty, Bridges, and short. This is long.
So
it's long.
What do we take away from that then? Because, you know, we talked about how political, you know, award season is. We talked about films of the moment. This seems like the kind of anti-material of now, and yet it's come through the same process at around the same time.
Well, it has,
so what's
but
it play?
I don't think it would be greenlit now. I think it's a film that feels 5 years out of date, really, and they might have kind of got away with it back then, but I don't think they will now. I think it's going to get quite a lot of criticism. I can't see it playing commercially either, and it looks expensive, and there's loads of locations across Europe, and there's all that big cast getting involved, many of whom are just kind of phoning it in. I also often just got confused. I'm like, which side are you
on?
Yeah,
I'm glad I nodded off.
Thank you for doing a bit of a Russian accent, Douglas Hodge, or I'd totally forget which side you were meant to be on, you know.
It's true. It was one of those films that I know I was awake, because it's 2.5 hours long, so that the possibility of nodding off is quite strong in me. And I kept thinking, I think I've missed a bit here. I just know whose side I'm on, or whose side she's on, or who's gaming who, or even who I want to win. I don't care about any of them. And to not care about Jennifer Lawrence, that takes some doing as well, because she's a tremendous actress as well, with a lot of empathy and a lot of humanity to it. And she doesn't bring it here. It doesn't bring the humour, doesn't bring the defiance, doesn't bring all this stuff that she does off screen onto the screen.
A damning indictment if you can think you've been asleep during a movie. Nevertheless, let's play a quick clip. Let's have a listen to this.
I was told to take a man to a hotel. And in exchange, my mother would get the doctor she needed. Instead, they cut his throat. There could be no witnesses. So they gave me a choice. Die or become a sparrow.
So that's Red Sparrow. Now, Jason, you alluded briefly to this. We must move on. But are there some truly appalling accents on display here?
Red Sparrow. Yes, there's terrible Russian accents. Charlotte Rampling sort of doesn't bother
with that. That was quite good.
I want
to the untrained
this.
Ear.
What
yeah.
Jeremy Irons could do, I can do better. I mean, I don't know what he was doing. I was talking to Tim earlier about this. This one scene with Jeremy Irons doesn't have much to do, and he just gets this cigarette out of his pocket, sort of fishes around for it to both pockets, then gets it out, then taps it on the, while he's talking, because the script's rubbish, and he taps it there and he tries it, then he puts it in his mouth and he sort of doesn't put it in, and I'm thinking, that's going in the wrong way around. That would be really hilarious. And then he doesn't light it at all, because they obviously cut. It's just sort of, you know, business. You know, it's
just business.
Business.
Yeah,
I need some business here. What business, Francis, can we do today?
Well, there you go. It's in cinemas today. If you still want to put yourself through it, it comes with an advisory from Jason and from Tim. That wraps up the film portion of today's programme. But, of course, there's still time for this week's Global Countdown. Bill Lutie joins us in the studio.
Hello.
Hello, Bill. Where are you taking us to? And will it be more entertaining than Red Sparrow?
Hopefully.
Let's hope so.
Normally I go to Asia, but I've flipped it and gone the opposite direction. We're going to go to Mexico.
Okay.
I'm going to basically ruin all of these Spanish words and names. Gerardo Ortiz with El Aroma de Tu Piel, which is the smell of your skin. I'm going to warn you, some of these backstories to some of these artists are quite dark. He's 28. He's huge in Mexico. People absolutely love him. He's winning Best Newcomer, Best Album, all this stuff, all over the place. He sings in a genre called Nacacorridos, which is kind of like a traditional Mexican folk music, but the lyrics are about drugs and cartels and murder and gangs and stuff.
Okay.
The lyrics are kind of approving of the lifestyle. So it's not like, you know, this is the thing that's happening, it's bad. And that kind of leads people to think that maybe these people might be involved a little bit in some of the crimes. So, you know, the front covers, he's like got a gun and he's got on a big black car and he's got all that stuff.
The trappings, one might
say.
Yeah.
This led to, in 2011, him, his manager and someone else that was working for the record company got held at gunpoint while they were just driving somewhere. And the manager got shot and was killed. He got shot as well, but managed to survive. So it's quite a troubled past. However, this song, it's about love and kissing.
Oh, that's nice. So it's a jaunty, jolly number.
Let's have a listen.
Gerardo Ortiz there. I thought that was quite jolly. And luckily, with my monoglot background, I can't tell what he's talking about.
He's talking about kissing and her hair and her waistline.
Beautiful.
And wanting to take her home and all of that.
Very jolly. Lovely stuff. Maybe he's a reformed character, Bill. Let's hope. What about number four? Who's there?
This is similar. This is Alfredo Olivas, another Nacacorridos, with quite a bad story. In 2015, he was on stage, thousands of people screaming up at him. One woman in particular caught his attention, so he thought, I'm going to give her my jacket. He took his jacket off, leant down to give it to her. As he did, the girl's boyfriend and another friend of hers didn't take kindly to this and let off 24 rounds, five of which went into him, killed two of his bandmates on stage. All of it's being filmed and is on YouTube. I didn't watch it. He survived. Incredibly.
So what you're saying is he's great live.
Yeah. Go and see him.
But only just.
This seems to be a slight trend with the Mexican top five today. It feels quite shooty in broad terms.
There's a lot going on, but this was a wake-up call to him. And he thought, right, no more. I'm going to turn my back on the crime world. So this song is a shift away from the drugs and the crime. And you can tell because it's called History of Guilt. Más ironía mis palabras. Ese día me puse mi orgullo de traje. No me importó que su mejilla se mojara. Y aunque la charla fue breve, duró lo suficiente como para herirla. El momento me costó tanto entenderla. Y ahora cómo le hago para conseguirla. Alfredo Olivas, so positively jaunty, Bill. Very cheerful, which is a good, I guess, evolution of a story that could have gone very much in a different direction. What about number three? More of the same? No. Luckily, no more death.
Okay.
From now until the top spot. We've all heard of this guy. It's Louis Fonsi. But this time he's teamed up with Demi Lovato. So they're two kind of powerhouses of international music at the moment. It's mostly in Spanish. Demi Lovato speaks Spanish, so she's done quite a good job. But she also does a little bit in English as well. It's very short. It's like 2 minutes and 50 seconds. Maybe, you know, it's so good. That's all you need. It's kind of pure, concentrated.
Or so bad. It's all you can take. Shall we have a listen?
Yeah.
Guilt in focus.
Yeah,
again,
throw me the blame. Put the blame on me, it's called.
We've been a bit deathy. We've been quite guilty. What about number two spot?
Number two. This is a real struggle. It's La Arroladora Banda y Limón de René Camacho.
Even jollier, Bill. That's felt more like frothy almost.
It is.
Is the message more positive?
It's between a kiss and a kiss. It's about kissing again.
Very nice.
But I mean, it's interesting that there's so much kind of folky style Mexican music.
A lot of mariachi.
Yeah, in the top five. This band, there's 18 of them. So there's plenty of them. That's maybe why they've got such a long name. The video, a little bit questionable. So there's like some schoolgirls. They run away from school. Their car breaks down. They have to push the car. Their little skirts like ride up as they're pushing the car. They get really hot. They cover themselves in water. They get changed. You see all.
So by a little bit questionable, you mean dodgy as hell.
Yeah, and then they arrive at their destination, which it turns out is the concert of this band. And then they all get up on stage and dance with the people. Some of the band members are young. Some of them are quite old.
Okay, so complex messaging throughout the top five so far.
Are we giving a snapshot of Mexican society, though, just in this rundown? Interesting, because some charts don't reflect the nature of their host nation, and this one seems to really do so.
It's giving us it's a good primer, I think, Jason. Well, what then, Bill, is at the top of the tree?
Well, it can only be Enrique Iglesias, can't it?
Oh my God.
Collective sighs.
I like Enrique, he's a hero.
What's he been up to?
He's back with his friend Bad Bunny.
Okay.
And is that the Mexican equivalent of Jive Bunny?
Let's hope it is. Is it Bill? Bill won't know what that is.
I know who Jive Bunny is.
Do you?
No, but this song is dividing fans.
Okay.
Because the lyrics are pretty hardcore. I'll read you the opening line, shall I? Every time I see you, you make me so hard to believe that you will be mine.
Oh, I see what he's done there. Thinks you're taking you one direction.
Switches
changes
back.
Changes it around.
Pivot.
Shall we have a listen to it?
We can do if you want.
Vámonos pa'l baño, que nadie nos está viendo. Si no me conoces, nos vamos conociendo. Sé que suena loco, pero me gusta tanto. Estar un día más así yo no lo aguanto. Vámonos a la luna, vámonos pa'l cine. Vamos a dar un beso que nunca se termine. Si quiere algo serio, hay que ver mañana. Si somos novios o somos pana.
So that was Enrique. I guess we didn't hear from Bad Bunny. Is he sort of your classic tough guy rapper? The name, again, a bit of a curveball, maybe.
Yeah, maybe, you know, you think that he's soft because of his silly name, and then actually he's hard as nails. Perhaps.
Lulls you into a false sense of security. Gentlemen, going to be rushing out to stream any of those in the top five?
Well, I could barely hear them because I'm not wearing headphones, so I need to explain that. So I'll have to listen to the podcast to get any clue.
But what about our dance moves? Did they bring
I mean, that was conveying
you?
A lot to me, yeah. But if, you know, if Shakira can get away with Hips Don't Lie, I think Enrique can say, yeah, you make me so hard.
There's a joke, there's a Bad Bunny joke, something to do with myxomatosis and mixing and toasting, and I can't quite get there, but come back to me next week and I'll have done it by then.
I mean, if that isn't an appointment you want to keep, I don't know what is. Thanks, one and all. That was great fun stuff. My guests, Tim Roby and Jason Solomons, and of course to Bill Lutie. Thanks too to our producer, Holly Fisher, and our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I'm Tom Edwards. We'll be back at the same time next week, but let's play out the show with some more of the song that's topping the Mexican charts. Here's Enrique and Bad Bunny, just for you, Jason Solomons. This is El Baño.
Cuando yo te vi, a mí se me paró el corazón, me dejó de latir. Quiero que estemos solos, por ti me descontrolo. Discúlpame, mi amor, por esta invitación. Vámonos pa'l baño, que nadie nos está viendo. Si no me conoces, nos vamos conociendo. Sé que suena loco, pero me gusta tanto. Estar un día más así yo no lo aguanto. Vámonos a la luna, vámonos pa'l cine. Vamos a dar un beso que nunca se termine. Si quiere algo serio, hay que ver mañana. Si somos novios o somos pana. Oh, 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 oh. Si somos novios o somos pana. Tranquila, hay que ver mañana. Si te vuelvo a ver, se me vuelve a parar la respiración por verte bailar. Si tú sabes que te gusto, ¿por qué te haces la loca? Cuando yo te miro, te muerde la boca. Yo solo quiero verte bailando sin ropa, en la misma cama, en la misma nota. Vámonos pa'l baño, que nadie nos está viendo. Si no me conoces, nos vamos conociendo. Sé que suena loco, pero me gusta tanto. Estar un día más así yo no lo aguanto. Vámonos a la luna, vámonos pa'l cine. Vamos a dar un beso que nunca se termine. Si quiere algo serio, hay que ver mañana. Si somos novios o pues somos pana. Oh, 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 oh. Si somos novios o pues somos pana. Tranquila, hay que ver mañana. Oh, 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 oh. Si somos novios o somos nada. Tranquila, hay que ver mañana.
Vacila que la vida va veloz. Igual que tu ex, que era medio precoz. Contigo siempre he hecho más de dos. Te calientas sola si ponen Tendy Bros. Tranquila, poco a poco me conoces.
Vámonos pa'l baño, que nadie nos está viendo. Si no me conoces, nos vamos conociendo. Sé que suena loco, pero me gusta tanto. Estar un día más así yo no lo aguanto. Vámonos a la luna, vámonos pa'l cine. Vamos a darle un beso que nunca se termine. Si quiere algo serio, hay que ver mañana. Si somos novios o pues somos pana. Oh, 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 oh. Si somos novios o pues somos pana. Tranquila, hay que ver mañana.